From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studio in La Crosse, and I am joined by author John Armbruster today. And John is, he's been a longtime educator and author, and he'll tell you all about this, but in his winding road through the educational system, he came in touch with the family of a man named Gene Moran, and Gene was a World War II veteran and has just the most interesting story. So we're going to talk with John today on Newsmakers about Gene's story, about John's own story, about how those intersect, and about John's book, which is called A Tailspin, and which is available now. First of all, John Armbruster, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thank you, Ezra.
Tell me about, we'll hear all about Gene later on, but he has an amazing story about his experiences during World War II. Tell me how you became acquainted with him and his family.
Sure. I moved to southwestern Wisconsin in 1994 with my first teaching job at North Crawford Schools. And I was about, 2 months into that job when I had an in-service, and North Crawford Schools hosted the in-service. Now, this is 1994, and I didn't know a lot of people then. I didn't feel like making small talk during a break in the in-service presentations. So I just sat and took in the conversations around me, and there were two men in front of me talking about a guy that fell 4 miles from the sky in World War II, and without a parachute, lived to tell the tale. And I leaned in and I was trying to pick up some details, but I remember they mentioned that the man was the father of Joni Peterson, who was North Crawford's art teacher. And so be it that Joni's room was right next to mine. And I was listening to the story. I'm like, I must have heard this wrong because this doesn't make any sense. And so at the end of the day, I burst into Joni's room and I said, oh my God, I heard this story about your dad. I think it's your dad. Is this true? Was he really a World War II tailed gunner that fell 4 miles and lived? And she said, yes, it is. And it's Lean Gene, the fighting machine, she called him. And of course, as a rookie history teacher, I'm like, oh my God, this is class presentation gold here. You know, we're going to have Gene come into my classroom and we're going to do projects and talks. And Joni quickly let me know that that is not going to happen. Joni was one of 9 children that Gene had, and none of them knew anything about their dad's story. They knew the basics. Many people around the Soldiers Grove area knew the basics, but Gene simply wouldn't talk about it. And I was told that that would be the same rule for me. Just we don't talk about it, and not that much is known other than the basic headlines from World War II. And Joni and I became friends over the years, and I got to know her dad and kind of became part of the family. Both my wife and my late wife and myself had lost our fathers early. So Gene kind of became a surrogate grandfather to my 2 sons. So we saw Gene at birthday parties and camp and bonfires and Packer games and such. But I knew for a long time, I never talked about the war with Gene, although I was dying to know. I was a World War II nerd when I was a kid, especially about airplanes. And I'm like, my God, this guy I'm sitting next to fired on Nazi fighter pilots. I just couldn't believe it. And but I never talked about it until 2007. Congressman Ron Kind hosted I call it a Gene Day in July of 2007. And Joni called up and said, oh my God, Dad's going to speak to Congressman Ron Kind. Ron Kind did a project called Veterans Oral History Project. And he interviewed Gene up at the La Crosse Airport, even brought in a Flying Fortress airplane from Oshkosh, from the EAA there to give Gene a ride. And Gene was featured in La Crosse Tribune and on both TV stations in La Crosse that day. But Ron interviewed him. To be honest, the interview didn't go that well. He interviewed him for 20 minutes. Gene's answers were very short, very cryptic. And then he actually asked that the interview stop. He just didn't want to talk much about it. And I remember Gene said that day after he got off the airplane and reporters are talking to him, and they said, well, it's the last time I'm ever going to do that. And I think he was talking more than just about the plane ride. he just wasn't going to talk about it. But then a few years later, you know, I guess that kind of broke the seal on the story, so to speak.
Okay.
And then the next few years, myself, there were veteran friends of Gene's, guys in the American Legion, that said, you know, you can't take the story to the grave. He was in his mid-80s at that point, and you have an incredible story. And I urge the family, too. I'm like, you've got to find an author for your dad's story. This has to be a book. And then Joni, that's Gene's daughter, approached me and said, well, why don't you do it? And I thought the idea was preposterous. I do have a journalism degree, but I, you know, I wrote for newspapers for about 2 years before I went. I knew I wanted to finish my teaching degree and teach. And I was like 20 years removed from writing.
So it's not like you had this whole career in journalism earlier. You had you had a degree in it. You wrote. Mm-hmm. I mean, our listeners will be familiar with the La Crosse Tribune, where you wrote for a little while. But it wasn't like a long, you know, deeply experienced journalist, suddenly a history teacher confronted with this amazing story.
Exactly. I mean, I one of the themes that I've given a lot of talks in libraries and other places throughout the state is I'm truly the accidental writer. I had no intention of doing this. I had no intention of a career as a writer. And I refused the Moran family at first. I'm like, no, you have to get a real author. And Joni came back a couple weeks later and said, well, he's not going to do it unless you do it. And Gene and I were friends. You know, I could talk to him. And so in that was late 2010, I decided to do it. And I had no idea what I was getting into because I had no idea of the work and effort that goes into producing a book. So it took 11 years.
So when you're getting ready to talk to Gene, knowing that he's been reluctant, knowing that he had, you know, the awkward experience of talking to, even though it was Congressman Ron Kind, a relative stranger about experiences that had affected him so profoundly, and that he, you know, didn't feel really great about all that. How do you, as somebody who's trained in journalism, as a former journalist, you're like, oh my gosh, people need to hear this story. Even as a teacher, you talked about, you know, hopefully this will result in something we can use to educate the students. And yet there's this respect for a subject who didn't ask for that attention and didn't, you know, is just a person who, as so many did during World War II, just did their duty and wanted to just come home. How did you end up balancing those two?
Oh boy. I remember, and this is chronicled in the book. When Gene and his new wife, Pauline, Gene was widowed in 2003 and in his mid 80s remarried. That tells you something about Gene. But his new wife, Gene, and then Joni, his daughter, we met to talk book talk. And the meeting did not go very well at first. Joni was very excited and she couldn't wait. And she went too far, saying, Dad, you have to talk about this. You have to talk about your POW experience. And she said something that tripped Gene and he blew up. And we're in a restaurant at this time in Soldiers Grove. And I thought, oh my God, this project's going to fail before we even get off the ground. And I told Gene, I said, I thought the project was dead right there. This is December 2010. And I said, Gene, this is your story. We don't have to do this. And he said, if we don't do it now, John, it will never happen. So we started interviews in January 2011, and we worked together on and off for 3 years. Gene died in 2014. And so the last 8 years, I was on my own and doing a lot of research to put this story together.
Wow. It's just amazing. The attitude of being sort of reluctant to telling the story is not unfamiliar, though. I mean, any of us who knew people from that generation, it's, you know, it's not like they came home and were all just screaming for attention. It seems like that generation of World War II veterans is particularly known, maybe stereotyped, maybe fairly so, or maybe unfairly so, but they're particularly known for coming home and not wanting to talk about it. Did Gene give you any indication about why that is, why that was such a prevalent thing among his generation?
No, he didn't. And, you know, it's funny, in the 3 years of working together, Gene never tried, you know, he never he never tried to find the bigger picture. He never lectured me about the bigger picture. He didn't speak religiously about his experience or politically, and never the big, you know, he never invoked the greatest generation, never said, here's why we didn't talk about it. He simply and slowly told his story. And you talk about the reluctance of that generation to talk, stereotypically or not. I did find many of Gene's comrades. I found relatives of Gene's comrades, and I'm like, great, research bonanza here. And I get the same story and over, and they say, sorry, John, would love to help you, but my dad, my uncle, whatever, hardly talked about it. So I did run across that, and that was a problem with my research time and time again.
Yeah, it's a familiar story. I'm remembering a very dear gentleman that I knew who died last year, earlier this year, actually, who was a World War II veteran. And he would tell you, like, I served in the war and I went to Iwo Jima and I did this thing. But he, like, the day-to-day, like, what that experience was like, I don't want to do it. I'd rather talk about cooking catfish and, you know,
exactly
hunting and fishing and my grandchildren and whatever. So you had all this work together to put this book together, and so much went into it even after Gene died. Documenting his actual story, though, like, what was that like? Was that like every day your mind is just blown by what he's been through? Or
yes. I can remember one time I had to stop an interview, and I always had a voice recorder with me. All of our interviews are voice recorded. I said, Gene, we got to stop. I have to take this in. And it was on his last mission, the story, when a German fighter pilot pulled right up next to his dying plane and gave him a chance to get out. And Gene described the story in detail. I'm like, my God, there was another story called Higher Call that had a similar story of that happening. And it wasn't the only story. Time and time again, Gene would tell me these stories. And after Gene died, and I'm putting together the story and I'm blocking it out, and I found a great editor to help me put the story together. There are times I was like, oh my God, no one's going to believe this. How is anyone going to believe this? This man had more lives than a cat. And so it took a lot of research, interviewing people, records from National Archives, accounts of other World War II veterans to put together the story. And I always tried to find anything that Gene said, tried to find something that would back it up from another source. And I often did. But yeah, that was a big fear of mine. And I've gotten that question too from and some of the talks I've given around the state. It's like, I think people are incredulous. It's like, did this really all happen? And then all I can say is yes, it did. And Gene, he was very matter of fact when he talked about it, very detailed. I never felt he was embellishing. In fact, I had to work so hard to pull details out of him. And he would often say, ah, John, it's been damn near 7 years. I don't remember. Do the best you can. And so that's why it took so long to write, because there was so much research that went into it to find more tidbits to flesh out these stories.
You talked about him falling so far from the sky and surviving, and people being incredulous about that, which is understandable. But mm-hmm. I don't know anything about World War II aircraft or any other kind of aircraft. But the flying fortresses, the B-17s, I'm just imagining how is it physically possible that someone would like pull up next to one of those and offer someone an opportunity to get out?
Yeah, Gene's plane. On a mission over Bremen, which was a very heavily defended city by the Germans, for some reason fell back from the rest of the planes, which was every airman's worst nightmare. And Gene never did figure out why their plane fell back. But when it did, it kind of became like the proverbial zebra being separated from its herd by a pack of lions. And the plane was just being riddled. Now remember, all these guys are mic'd up, so Gene could hear his friends dying. This crew is, these guys are very close. And plane is dying, it's about to be finished off, and yes, this German pilot pulled up right next to him, and Gene said, I remember when he told me, I said, my God, you've never told anyone this. How close was this guy? And we're in his mobile home at this point. He's like, from me to the TV away. And I'm like, what? And wow. He said, oh, I could see his scarf. I could see his goggles. I could, you know, see his facial features. And he pointed down twice, and he said, at first I didn't understand what he wanted, and then it finally dawned on me that he wanted me to bail out. And because he said the plane was just shredded at that point and many of the crew had died. Pilot must have still been alive, keeping that plane level. But then someone fired on that German plane and it immediately flipped over and took off. And then waiting German pilots moved in for the kill. So Gene had a reprieve, and that reprieve was gone as soon as someone shot at the other plane.
Wow.
And then it became a nightmare of cannon shells exploding and machine gun bullets. And Gene was shot and wounded several times. And then as the plane starts to go down, his parachute was shot. A bullet went right through it and just shredded it, silk strands everywhere. So Gene crawls forward to get a spare parachute, and the plane ripped right in front of him. And he could see the two ace gunners. They were both dead. And he said he almost fell out. He said the plane ripped and sky opened up in every direction. And he just yanked his body around. It was just the tail section. That was all that was left. He yanked his body around. He said he just relaxed and he just accepted death and crashed into a forest in northwestern Germany.
I can't imagine what that must have been. I mean, I wrote that's a quote that you have shared before that I wrote down. I just relaxed. I'm going to die. Why fight it?
Yeah, he had a rosary ring from his grandmother. He pulled out of his pocket and he just started praying the Hail Marys. But one thing he pointed out to myself and also to the nephew of one of the waste gunners that visited him. In this whole process, he said, your life really does flash before your eyes when you're about to die. He said he could remember certain scenes. He said, it's the God's honest truth. Your life flashes before your eyes. And when he hit the ground, he at first thought he was dead. And through some crazy miracle, the plane kind of swung him to the ground, where he was able to crawl out of the tail section and onto the ground. And he had been blinded by the G-forces, which had pushed blood into his eyes, so he couldn't see other than haze and some light. But he crawled to the light, thinking he was dead, because, you know, that's the story. We crawl to the light. But when he got out, he could feel the cold air, the leaves, and the twigs of the forest floor. And he was fully conscious. And he said his first reaction was to start laughing because he had cheated death. He just started giggling. He felt no pain until a few moments later, he could feel a strange sensation from his head. And he went up to feel it, and he had a leather flight helmet on, and it was torn. And he could feel his brain because he had about a 7-inch skull fracture when he crashed into the forest. And at that point, he knew he was going nowhere. So he just laid on the ground and waited for his captors.
It's an amazing story, and we're going to hear much more of it. It's the story of Gene Moran, and we're talking with John Armbruster, who is the author of the book Tailspin, which is about Gene's story. We're going to hear more of Gene's story, what happened when he was captured. We'll talk to John about his interest in World War II aircraft and how that came about, and how this book intersects with not only Gene's story, but John's own story as well. That's all coming up on Newsmakers. Remember, if you'd like to reach out to the show this week or at any time, you can do that. Send us an email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our program continues in just a moment. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking to John Armbruster today, author of the book Tailspin. John, you've been telling us about Gene's story, and we will get back to that in just a moment, including what happened to him when he knew he was going to be finally captured after his plane had come down. But I want to know about your interest in World War II aircraft. You said you were kind of geeked about it as a kid. When did that start?
Third grade. I remember my first World War II book was actually about flying fortresses, ironically. And I was the kid in middle school and high school that was in a corner of the library reading World War II books instead of doing my homework. So I was always fascinated by that era of history. And it's funny, as a history teacher, I'll be studying my 30th year teaching. Every year I get a World War II geek in my class, both boys and girls, that know all the airplanes. I don't know what it is about those propeller airplanes. It was the end of an era because jets took over after that, but just seemed to capture the imagination of kids, and it did me. So yeah, I know all the, I have been to Oshkosh several times. I rode on a flying fortress for the first time last summer to experience what Gene and his comrades experienced.
What was that like?
It's been a life. To be honest, I had to throw up at the end of it.
I've heard it's pretty horrible.
The noise, and you would think of, you know, it was a level flight. It's not like we're under combat conditions, but. And what was great is that on this Flying Fortress ride, I got to have the, they let us walk around the airplane. And so I sat in each position on the plane of the characters that I wrote about that were Gene's friends. But at the end of it, I got very airsick. And I remember afterward, it was a gift from my girlfriend, Chris, for completing the book. And the pilot wanted to give Chris a tour of the airplane. And I'm like, well, heck, I'm tagging along too. And I'll be darned if I'm going to throw up in front of the pilot and my girlfriend. But I held it long enough and then threw up later. Sorry to, no mean to gross out your listeners. But I think what struck me about that airplane ride is just how expendable these airmen were. I mean, there were no creature comforts. These guys had to suffer sub-zero temperatures. As the day Gene was shot down, it was like around 50 below when he was up at 28,000 feet. And there's just sharp edges everywhere. These planes were not pressurized. They had to have oxygen masks, which often froze up or clogged. There were just so many ways these guys could have died or gotten hurt. And the, you know, when you read about the 8th Air Force and the air war over Europe, the casualties were horrendous. These guys were expendable. And I saw that, I felt that on that airplane ride on a Flying Fortress last summer.
It's interesting to hear you say that because those planes are so beautiful. And from just an aesthetic perspective of looking at it from the outside, they look so cool. And
yes.
And they're just, I mean, you talked about being interested in them as a child, but like, I don't know any kid who has seen one of those planes either at the air show, if you're lucky enough to see one in person, or just pictures of them or drawings or whatever. And they're just amazing looking things, but the reality of it is it's really, really brutal and not at all glamorous and really harsh. Did Gene talk about his experience in those planes from an aesthetic point of view, or from like you said, creature comforts point of view?
Yeah, it's he felt the same way about the Flying Fortress. It's like you said, aesthetically, they're beautiful planes. And the Americans had two primary bombers, four-engine bombers in Europe, the B-17 Flying Fortress and the B-24 Liberator. And Gene said when they're going through training, everybody wanted the Flying Fortress because, as Gene said, it was sexy. It had curvy lines. To him, it looked like a girl, whereas the B-24 Liberator was much more boxy and looked more like a stub-nosed pig, and it wasn't as glamorous. And he always hoped he'd get the Flying Fortress, and he did. So, you know, he's a tail gunner, an iconic position in an iconic plane in the largest air war of all time. And at times it's just some of the things that where Gene was and what he saw, even during his POW experience, I'm like, the guy's like Forrest Gump. He's just like everywhere. And he's in the middle of this air war. But as far as creature comforts, there's not. He said too, most of the guys, you know, these flights were very long. There was no bathroom. And there was something that they called a P-tube up in the radio room, but it was, you know, you got to fish through five layers of clothing to relieve yourself in the air. And the most of the guys just sat in their own urine by the time they got back from their flights, just because it was so incredibly uncomfortable. And there just wasn't much thought into creature comforts or safety for these men on these airplanes. Yeah, they look great, but the reality is something different.
Now, this book includes Gene's story, harrowing as it is. It's also there's also some of your own experiences that are part of it. Talk about that, and what made you decide that this was a good vehicle to kind of marry these two stories?
Yes, that was a suggestion by my editor. When I met my editor in 2013, I met her at a writing conference in Madison, and it was truly at a point I needed help. This is my first book, and she saw the potential. She was a Heather Shoemaker. She's a published author herself. And we're putting the story together, and she said, God, she goes, these interviews you have with them sound fascinating. Can we weave the story of Gene as an old man, you know, coming to terms with the story, the difficulty he had talking about it as part of the narrative? I'm like, yes, I like that idea. So we start off each chapter with Gene as an old man, and then we morph into the war story. And then as we're putting the story together, my editor's like, wait a minute. So during the 3 years of when I was interviewing Gene, my wife died of cancer. And it was right in the middle of the interviews when my wife died, and she had a 10-year battle with breast and brain cancer. And my editor, when she learned this, she's like, wait a minute. Your wife is dying in the middle of all this? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I remember her exact words. As a reader, I need to know this. If you are going to put yourself as a character with Gene at that interview table, Gene is an old man, and your wife is dying. And on top of that, Gene and my late wife were friends, very good friends. She says, this has to be part of the story. And at first I refused. I said, no. I said, it was awful. I lived it. I had two young sons at the time when she died. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And, but I saw, it took some subtle pressure by my editor. And after a while, I saw what she was trying to do. And she noted the irony. It's like, well, you want Gene to give up a terrible story, and now you won't. And they all blend together. Gene and your wife knew each other. So basically, we put together a story, Unbroken, another World War II story with Tuesdays with Maury, that interviewing an old man, and then Steel Magnolias, I guess. And I told my editor, I'm like, okay, this is either going to really work or it's going to be terrible, because people might be picking up a World War II story and say, why am I getting a cancer story here too? At the risk of being immodest, reaction to the format has been overwhelming. People love it. I've had some long lines at book signings, and people are just mention how unique this story is. So again, everything kind of happened accidentally, including myself being a writer for this book.
You were hesitant to share the story, and no surprise why. I mean, it involves, you know, what at that time was the pretty recent passing of your late wife. Gene had 60 plus years to process and contemplate whether he wanted to share his deeply personal story, and you had far less time than that, and the impact of it was so much more recent. You pointed out the irony that your editor was talking about of him sharing this deeply personal story and your reluctance to it. Is that what brought you around? Did you view that, like, his story as sort of a motivational factor for you?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it was a process. I remember when I first started writing, interweaving my story with Gene as an old man, I remember my editor would send me back my rough drafts, and she would be very blunt. She said, this isn't good. She goes, I'm not feeling it. You're dancing around the issue. You're not being honest. You're not being emotionally honest. And she did that a few times. And then I remember writing angry. And this was about 4 or 5 years after my death. And I said, all right, you want to know what it's like? Here's what it's like. And so I wrote a couple chapters, just it was like angry writing, and every detail and every raw emotion, I put it there in a rough draft. And I sent it to her, and she responded and said, oh my God, she said, you had me crying 3-4 times. I could barely get through this. She said, you're finally becoming a writer. So it was a process. It just was. And I recognized the irony of me giving up a story I didn't want to give up, and asking a man to give up a story that he didn't want to give up. So it becomes a twin story in a way. But I do think Gene and his World War story is still the focus. So I think people that are fans of history and fans of World War II will still enjoy the World War II story as well.
And we're gonna hear more from John Armbruster about Gene's story when we come back. You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. And you can find, if you missed part of our conversation today, you can find this episode, all the rest of our shows on our website as well. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. And we're going to continue with Newsmakers right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin Bureau, and I'm talking to John Armbruster today, who is the author of Tailspin. And we've been talking to John a little bit about his own story that is interwoven as part of this book, but it's mainly the story about Gene Moran, who is a Soldiers Grove native who was a B-17, a gunner on a B-17 flying fortress during World War II. Amazingly, his plane was shot down. It fell 4 miles from the sky, and Gene lived to tell the tale. And that's where we're picking up the story right now. The plane, as you heard earlier in our conversation, has been lost, and Gene fell with it and is now on the ground, has realized that he's still alive, but he's about to be captured. John, tell me how Gene recounted how he actually came to be captured by the Germans.
Sure, you bet. And just so your listeners know, I've been to the very spot where Gene fell. The Germans know this. Yeah, the Germans know the story much better than we do. And in 2018, they actually had a 75th anniversary commemoration that they invited myself and members of Gene's family and members of other crew to attend. And I remember being in the woods, and there was a German television crew there that was following us. And the television crew came up to me and said, you know, Ken, you're the author, you're doing the research. Can you explain how he survived falling 4 miles in a piece of wreckage and surviving? Now, when I went there to Germany, I was expecting some Bavarian hills with large pine trees and that would cushion his blow somehow, but it was a very nondescript woods. It was flat, marshy, spindly trees. And I guess it had been a woods, I mean, obviously 75 years, the woods would change, but I guess it had been a woods for quite some time. I looked around, there was just no explanation. And I looked at the television crew, I'm like, I have no idea. I cannot explain, nor will I try in the book, try to explain how he survived. But once he hit the ground, he, at this point, he had been shot in both arms, his ribs had been broken, and then he had a skull fracture and an exposed brain at that point. And he figured these wounds out, and he knew he wasn't going anywhere. And ironically, was found first by Frenchmen, and he could hear their voices. There was a POW camp nearby where Gene crashed and where he landed that would allow its French prisoners to leave prison to scrounge for food. This was 1943. France was under German occupation, so they really didn't worry about these guys escaping because there was no place to escape to. Their homes were occupied by the Nazis. So they would let the French prisoners out scrounging for food. And what they'd learned to do was to watch for air raids and look for downed planes, because there were a lot of goodies on those crash planes that you could steal, particularly Hershey bars, which were part of an airman's rations. They would steal those. But they would steal like anything, wires, particularly any radio equipment that they liked to use for making homemade radios. So they had watched Gene's tail section crashing to the ground. They ran up to Gene, said he was lying there for about 4 minutes when he heard the voices, but they were French and it confused him. He could tell he couldn't speak French, but he recognized a few words in the accent. They thought Gene was dead, so they're rifling through his clothing and is ripping the microphone from his neck. And then Gene started speaking to them that he needed a doctor, and they just freaked out. They just left from him and just started chattering excitedly, like, oh my God, you know, this guy fell 4 miles in the wreckage of a plane and lived. Then they disappeared, and then they came back with German soldiers. And that was critical because as an airman, it was well known, you wanted to be captured by the German military, not by the German police or civilians. The civilians and often the police, they absolutely hated the Allied flyers, both British and American, because their bombs missed targets all the time, and there were so many civilian casualties. they hated the American Flyers, thought they were gangsters, thought they were murderers. So you didn't want to be captured by the civilians who would just kill you outright. Even the most grievously wounded, they would. So Gene was captured. He recognized, he could hear the soldiers come to him. They threw him on an ox cart. He was only about 20 where he fell. But then he was almost killed after that because the Germans took that ox cart through a town and paraded him through town, and he was attacked by the civilian population of that town. Gene could, he could hear them coming for him. They rocks were hitting the cart. He could feel spit on his face, and then the cart started rocking. And he thought, and I remember Gene telling me, he said, "Oh my God, I've lived through all this, and now I'm going to die right here at the hands of civilians." And Gene could hear the shouting and the yelling, and the there was one voice above the others, must have been a sergeant or something, that shoved, pushed away the rest of the German civilians. And ironically, it was the German soldiers that saved Gene's life as they were taking him to a POW camp. Because if the civilians had gotten a hold of him, Gene would have been killed. And the Flyers knew that. They had heard a lot of grisly stories of downed Flyers being lynched. So Gene was saved by German soldiers.
Not only was he protected from being executed by, as you said, German civilians or police had they gotten a hold of him first, but really the fact that he was captured led to him getting the medical attention that he needed to survive. And as you put it, he turns out to have been lucky to have been found and captured in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, he was transported to San Basil POW camp, which is now a museum, and I've been there as well. And there were two Serbian doctors that were at this POW camp. From my research, I these men, and from the prison the prisoner archivist that showed me the POW camp, these guys were doing like 30, 40 surgeries a day. I mean, it was a lot, it reminded me of MASH. I hear about the term meatball surgery, you know, get him in, patch him up. They found Gene and they thought, well, let's see what we can do. I mean, he was near death. They sewed a flesh plate into his head. That was the first thing they took care of, was his head wound. And the French POWs would tease Gene later on when he recovered and was able to speak, that the French would say, "Oh, you're part Russian now. You must like vodka."
For well over a year, in fact, about a year and a half, he was in the captivity of the Germans. And how much did he tell you about what that was like after his medical recovery? It must still have been a really harrowing experience.
First, there was the interrogation phase, which happened at a place called Dulag Luft down in Frankfurt. And then he was in two other POW camps on the Eastern Front of the war. They put them there because he was in the furthest east of the Allied POW camps, what is now the border of Lithuania. That was his first camp. Gene did open up and talk to me about that POW experience. And I think by that point, you know, we're a couple of years into interviews here, and he was becoming more comfortable talking about it. The first camp, even on the way to these camps, his train filled with POWs had come under attack by American and British planes. And Gene and the other guys would be all nervous and scared. And Gene said, again, he just relaxed and thought, well, if a bomb blows this train up, so be it. There's nothing I can do. And so again, he survives. And when he was transferred, when the Russians were coming in July of 1944, he was transferred into another POW camp. But there was a transport phase called the Hellship. There, Gene had a lot of difficulty talking about the Hellship, and it's one of the most heinous POW stories of World War II. The Germans packed 1,000 guys onto a ship, which maybe had room for 100. They were two rusty coal freighters. Conditions were, it was mid-July, there was no ventilation, there was no food, there was no bathroom, there was no light. Oh. They were packed. It was disgusting. I remember when Ron Kind asked Gene about that in 2007, and Gene wouldn't talk about it. He said it just wasn't good. And ironically, in one of those quirks of history, there was a POW that lived in La Crosse at the time. His name was Jim Millen, and he just died a few years ago at the age of 97. I had heard about him, and he agreed to help me with Gene's story. He was also on that Hellship, and he provided me some details. And it was a ghastly ghastly story. And then Gene went to his second POW camp in what is now Poland, but Germany at the time. And this was a camp that was terrible, not so much because of cruelty, but just because it's getting the end of the war and it's there's just no food. And disease was rampant and men are losing weight rapidly. And then that camp was also evacuated in February of 1945. And then another part of the story, which I'm glad my book brings light on, Gene had a 600-mile forced march at the end of the war. Now, he and many of the prisoners were in terrible condition at this point. I mean, they're disease-ridden, their clothing's filthy. And Gene and Jim Millen of La Crosse, who helped me with the story, who also survived this death march, estimated about 1,000 Americans died on this death march, which is similar to the numbers of the Bataan death march in the Philippines in 1942. But so little is known about that death march because when Gene was and his comrades were finally liberated, the Allies, British, Americans, and Russians are finding the concentration camps, particularly the Jewish concentration camps, which is dominating headlines at this point. So the death march, the European death march, kind of got lost in the headlines. It got lost to history. So I think one of the more satisfying parts of writing this book was bringing some light to that story. I remember Jim Millen of La Crosse, who was also in that death march. He would talk about how prisoners would drop and Germans would just shoot them and then toss them into a forest. So I'm sure those men were included in the MIAs of World War II. You know, no one ever found out what happened to them. Their families, they just vanished into history. Mm. So I'm glad that my book has brought attention to the European death march.
I want to ask you about that because this death march, this 600-mile forced march, were they on the way from somewhere to somewhere? Or what was the point of all the marching around?
Yes, simply the point was move west and get away from the Russians. The okay. Germans feared the Russians. If they had to lose the war and be captured, they wanted to be captured by the British or Americans. So it was always to move west. Now, at first, Gene and his POW comrades couldn't understand why didn't they just let them go? What's the point of keeping these guys? Through some of my research, and this I'm a bit sketchy about, it seemed to be that Hitler and some in the German high command wanted to keep these POWs as bargaining chips for a negotiated settlement at the end of the war. By keeping these guys, they had some leverage at the end of the war. When they removed the first time, when they removed again in February of 45, again, Gene and the guys can't understand why did the Germans want to keep them. Many of them thought they were going to be shot, that they were just going to be taken into a field and gunned down because the Germans hated the American flyer and the British flyers so much. And they never could understand why the Germans just kept them. And then after a while, the reasons for keeping them became moot as the idea is everyone just wants to get west, get to the Americans, get to the British before the Russians capture you. So it's this disjointed back and forth 600-mile death march, and they're falling. And not so much from cruelty, as the German guards were just as miserable as the prisoners, but just from neglect and disease and malnutrition.
You said that this book has, among other things, Steel Magnolias and other things. You said there's a bit of a Tuesdays with Maury vibe. Tuesdays with Maury, of course, being by the author Mitch Albom. I was interested in your experience talking to Gene in this ongoing series of conversations that you had with him. Were there takeaways for you? You said Gene was not particularly introspective about this. It was just data almost that he was recounting to you. But when you're thinking about it, like, are you putting it in context? Are you learning like life lessons from this?
You know, I never did at first when I had all the interviews and I start putting the story together and I'm thinking of terms of it's like an architect building a house. It's like, all right, we're gonna put the pieces together. Let's make the different levels and layers. So I was always very clinical, very analytical about how do we make this a great story. Ironically, it was when I was listening to the interviews for about the third time in preparation for the book launch party that we had in La Crosse this past April, when I used some of the quotes as part of a presentation that night, some of Gene's actual quotes to play for the crowd. And this time I got to sit back and listen to them with a little bit more introspection by myself. And I think the takeaway I got was, my God, you could hear, I don't know why I didn't notice it the first two times. You could hear Gene's pauses. You could almost hear him swallowing. You could hear his deep breaths. And I realized how hard this was for him to keep going. I didn't appreciate his bravery, his stamina to keep going with this story until I listened to them the third time and really listened to the quotes. And that to me was an epiphany that what I asked Gene to do was much harder than I had at first thought. I had 28 recorded conversations, and they were generally 1 hour to maybe 2 hours in length. And then also many phone calls as well, just kind of backup. It's like, Gene, could you go over this with me again? Or Gene, what did you mean by this? And I would usually over the phone ask him very, data-driven questions, more like how many planes in this raid, which guy did this, who got hurt here? So there were a lot of phone conversations as well. But I would say the bulk of the book comes from 28 recorded interviews with Gene over a three-year period.
And Gene was a family friend of yours whom you've gotten to know for a long period of time. Did this series of conversations kind of usurp that, or were you able to maintain a friendship with him and his family separate from these 28 conversations?
Yeah, it's funny. Before we started working on the book, I mean, Gene came to my son's birthday parties and their first communions and a few bonfires where I always made sure to have Gene's favorite beer, Blatt's beer, ready for him to go. But as we were getting into the interviews, my wife is slowly dying, so there just wasn't as many social activities between Gene. So there was almost like two parts of our relationship. Those first 5, 6, 7, 8 years when we got to know each other and the family as friends, and then the last 3 years as author, as interviewer and subject, they were kind of two distinct periods in our relationship.
And you worked on the book for years after he passed away. Either you know when he died or in the years later working on the book, what came to your mind through that process that you wish you had the opportunity to talk to him about, or you wish that he would have covered in more detail, or that you wish you would have thought to ask him?
Oh God, everything. Just I remember when I met my editor in 2013, she said, and Gene was alive then yet, she said, your first priority is to get as many interviews in with Gene and ask every question you possibly can. He's not going to live forever. And I was flippant about that because I'm like, oh my God, he's Gene Moran. He's the Man of Steel. He can, you know, he had survived a heart attack at age 88. He's never going to die. And he died at age 89 in 2014. So I was glad that I got in as many interviews as I could. But yes, after 2014 and then working on it for 8 years by myself, there was always, you know, oh God, I wish it could be anything. It could be about his bomber crewmates. It could be about, you know, a POW house, the bed, you know, did the bed have slivers? Did you have a pillow? What was the pillow made of? Things like that, that I had to find out from other accounts of World War II guys that had been through these experiences. So yeah, there were always questions and little details that I wanted to ask and second guess myself. Why didn't I ask him this? But, you know, luckily that generation did start to write its stories in the last 20 to 30 years of their life. So there were some very good accounts of that, especially the POW experience that I was able to lean on in my research.
We're talking to John Armbruster today on Newsmakers. John is the author of Tailspin, and it's the book containing the story of Gene Moran's life. Gene, who was a bomber on the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress in World War II, and his harrowing experiences. I can't let you go, John, without giving you an opportunity to tell people who are now have heard our entire conversation and want to know where I can get this book. Tell us how we can get the book, how we can get in touch with you and find more information.
You bet. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you can also get the book from my publisher, 1016 Press. And I guess I prefer that you order directly for them so that they get the biggest cut, because my publisher produced a beautiful book. They are located out of Waukesha, Wisconsin. There's a link to it on my website, johnmarmbruster.com. That'll get you to my publisher to order a book. It's available in gift stores in Viroqua and Westby. I know you can get it at Barnes & Noble if you order it. We've had a few supply chain issues just with books being printed and getting the books. The same economic problems that you're hearing throughout the rest of this country of workers and raw material shortages have caused some delays in this book. But also you can look at my website. I have a number of speaking events in Wisconsin. I've got over 30 so far throughout this year. And you can look there too, where I'll be speaking in southwestern Wisconsin. And I'll also be selling books at those speaking events.
And that website, once again, is johnmarmbruster.com?
Exactly, all lowercase.
All right, John, thank you very much for sharing this wonderful story with us and for being here on Newsmakers.
You bet, Ezra. Thank you very much.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to get in touch with our program, you can reach out to us, newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. My producer is Dawn Jewell. And for Dawn and the rest of the crew here in La Crosse, thank you very much for listening. And join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.